This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and does not replace your own financial, tax, legal, or financial product advice.
Tiny homes, they're so popular. Everyone's talking about them. Everyone's trying to build them. It often comes up because housing, it's not accessible always for everyone, right? It's wild. And I know a lot of you who are maybe more conscious about your footprint or you like things cozy, you're really interested in the whole tiny home thing. So on today's episode, I'm chatting with Benj. He's a listener of the My Millennial Money podcast. And yeah, we just have a chat about his own tiny home journey. His story, it isn't going to be the same as everyone else's, but it might encourage you with your own tiny home, or it might just answer questions that you may have had. We do answer questions from the Facebook group, and it's just a really good chat. And I just love hearing stories from different people throughout our community. So let's have a chat with Benj about his journey building a tiny home. You're listening to My Millennial Money. Okay, so I'm with Benj, who's joining us to talk about all the tiny home stuff. Before we get into the chat, I'm going to throw to Benj to do an acknowledgement. Benj.
Hey, Glenn. Happy to be here. Wanted to, first of all, acknowledge the Jabiru people who are the traditional custodians of the land that I'm recording on today. We're situated off the eastern side of the beautiful Gariwerd mountain ranges in Western Victoria. And I'd wholeheartedly like to pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. And I'd really like to extend that respect to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who might be listening to this podcast elsewhere in Australia, or even, yeah, possibly somewhere else in the world.
Absolutely wonderful. And we are recording on dark and young country. So there you have it. Now, I've just got a heap of questions from the Facebook group that I'm just going to throw to you. Some of them you might not be able to answer, which is fine. We're just having a chat here. But let's just rewind. Tell me a little bit about you, your situation, what you do for life, what you wanted to create, why you wanted to create it. And then we'll just see where this little ride takes us.
Yeah, geez. I guess it depends how far back you want to go with this.
Well, I don't care what school you went to as a child. Yeah. But, what do you do for work?
So I work as a project firefighter here in Gariwerd, also known as Grampians National Park in Victoria. I started this job in 2018, came on for the 2018-19 fire seasons as a pretty fresh face on the fire crew, and went straight into one of the craziest fire seasons, yeah, going round. Yeah, I've been doing that for ever since then, so the last three seasons and fourth season, including this one. But yeah, I guess we moved back in 2018 back to the Grampians because I originally grew up here. Yeah, I'd purchased a block off my mum. She'd subdivided this block from our original block that I grew up on. It's just like a little 2-acre block. So I moved back with the dream of building a little house on it. Yeah, which I started, we poured the slab in 2018, in May, I think it was. Yeah. Yeah, I poured the slab and my dad said to me straight away, yeah, well, there's no turning, there's no turning back now, mate. Like, you're all in. So,
wow. So, okay. So, I'm just going to unpack a couple of things here.
There's a lot there. Sorry, mate. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's fine. Your mum and dad split the block?
Yeah, it goes a bit deeper than that. They ran accommodation on the 120 acres that we had when I was growing up. Dad and mum built some unique cottages down one end of the block. It was like a rectangle and we lived on the other end. Sure. They ran it as a business and then eventually they parted ways and became neighbours. Dad built another cottages down there and lived there.
Yeah.
So they eventually continued to subdivide just small blocks off. They did two each and then, I bought one off mum.
And how big is your plot?
It's just over a hectare. So I guess 2 acres pretty much.
And Do you have a relationship, a partner? Do you live by yourself?
Yeah, I do. I've got a beautiful partner, Holly, who lives with me. We live together in the house that we've built.
Yeah.
It's situated on sort of one side of the block, but we were also living in a little shack over in the corner of the block for about 2.5 years while we were building this house. And, yeah, we've been living in the house now for, I think since we got the occupancy permit in November 2020. So what's that, like 15, 16 months or something?
Yeah. And it's really good for me to do this interview with you because I had wanted to do one around tiny homes for some time. And I think it's good that you actually have been through the process, but you've also lived in it for, you know, coming up to 18 months.
Yeah.
So you really have a really good understanding of what it's like to live in a tiny home. Now, just on the tiny home that you have, and I will shout out the Instagram, if everyone wants to just have a look, if you're not driving or whatnot, Nook on the Hill, but Nook underscore on underscore the underscore hill. Smash that follow button, give Benj a follow and just scroll through, and there's lots of photos of him building the tiny home. What got you really, I guess, thirsty for tiny homes before you started?
Well, there's so many reasons. First of all, like, I guess it's important to prefix this with that this tiny home is a permanent structure, so it's built on the land, on a slab, and it's not on a trailer. I don't know, like, originally it was down to budget. Like, I thought that by building small, I would be able to afford to build a house. And I sort of had a rough idea of how much I wanted to spend on the house, which was so far off what it actually cost, but that's all right.
What do you think it cost you?
I reckon for the structure itself, it did be $140,000. But I reckon all up, like, with everything else that's on the block, like the garden, water, power, everything's probably, it's probably around $180,000. That's including tools purchased for the project and all of the planning permits and engineering sign-off and everything. That would have cost, I think that cost about $12,000 before I'd even broken ground. So,
yeah,
there's a lot of additional costs.
And so going back to this concept that you and Holly obviously wanted a tiny home, like, it sounds to me that it's got to be about more than the money as well.
Yeah, there's definitely a lifestyle. Like I said, like, it definitely started off as like, oh, maybe this is the only size house that I can actually build. But it turned into more than that, and it was already more than that. I guess by building small, you have a minimal footprint impacted on the earth you're building on, and so by that, especially if you're building on a slab, it means there's less concrete involved, which is environmentally sustainable, well, more environmentally friendly than using more concrete. And I guess by building small, you can be a lot more smart. It forces you to downsize your life and not store so many things or have too many unnecessary things. I mean, we still have a container. We still have a little garden shed, so there's plenty of room for lots of things to get stored up that probably shouldn't be here, but that's okay. And I think it just gave me the opportunity to flex a bit of design. Like, you're setting up this parameter where it's fixed. You know, you've only got this much space, this much space to do what you can with it, and you've got to be as smart as possible to get as much out of every centimetre in the house, which really, like, that pushes you pretty hard.
What's the square meterage of your tiny home?
So to the outside perimeter of the house, it is 4 meters by 6 meters. But being on the inside, you've got a double brick wall, which is 270 mil thick on the whole perimeter. So you're taking like almost half a meter off. So, you know, it's well under, it's probably like 3.5 meters wide on the inside and, maybe 5.5 on the inside long. And so the actual usable space, 6 by 4 downstairs, so 24 meters downstairs, and then upstairs it's got like a mezzanine floor, so it's sort of 2/3 the size of the house, which is another, I guess.
Yeah, and I turned my I turn my head not to be rude, but realistically, it may be a little bit smaller than a double car garage.
Yeah, like downstairs. You're probably not wrong. You're not wrong. Mm. I mean, if you park in this house, you'd probably...
Yeah, where do you park your car?
Well, we just park outside, yeah.
And then upstairs is, yeah, mezzanine, half of that.
So you're looking at about 36 meters to use.
Yeah. So you really like the idea of small, cozy, less of an environmental impact. You know, we've got the double brick, so that's insulation. And I'll get you to say what else you've done. But also I'm hearing like, yeah, we've got less storage stuff, so we're not buying more stuff just because. So we have to live intentional. Is that right?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, Holly and myself aren't really... You know, we don't buy too many material objects. We sort of really think about things before we purchase them already. So, I mean, that was already playing into our hand a bit. But, yeah, certainly living in it now, like, I mean, some friends offered to give us, like, a food processor for free and Holly was keen to take it and I was just like, oh, mate, where are we even going to put that thing? Like, there's no room for it. So, yeah, we took it. It's in the container.
Just turn your camera around just so I can have a bit of a look live on air.
So I'm on the bed at the moment.
Okay, and you're upstairs?
Yeah. So
yeah. Oh, a little stairwell. Oh, wow. So just stop there for a second. The bed overlooks out the window, and you can probably see this on Instagram.
Yeah.
Really nice solid timber, open like glass. So that whole wall is basically a big timber frame and truss with glass. So that's just amazing, looking out to the hills of the country.
Yeah.
See-through balustrade. Wow.
Yeah.
Lots of natural light.
Yeah, lots. And I mean, that came with a lot of challenges. Yeah, making the entire front facade out of beams and glass was a bold decision from somebody who's never built a house before. But made it work.
So on the building... Did you own a builder or did you pull the trigger and get a company to build that for you?
No, I built the whole thing. I built the whole thing myself as an owner builder. I mean, obviously there's people that come in and out as contractors and friends and whatnot who help you with some of the grunt work and their specialty, because there's just some things you can't do yourself legally as well. I pretty much did everything except for the plumbing, the brickwork, and the slab, although I did help pour the slab.
And the electrical?
So my brother's a Sparky. So cool. He and I worked together and did that together. Yeah.
So when you're going, and there are questions here with the council, like what happens, like is there, I have no idea, like I just saw the bush, like are you guys on town water anyway?
No, like we collect our own water here, yes. So we've got a bore as well for the house. So that supplies into a big tank and then we utilise that. We are on the grid for electricity. But
is there is there town water anyway, if you could?
It's about a K and a half away.
Yeah.
So
yeah, so it was not really feasible.
Yeah, getting that is just, be extreme. Yeah. So a lot of people out here, just collect their own water.
And what about waste and sewage? Is there, like, is it a septic type situation?
Yeah, so with the we've got a septic. A lot of people have wastewater treatment systems which run constantly and provide airflow and treat the waste. But there's a rule around here that if you have over a hectare, you can have a septic system. So
just explain that to people just so they really understand.
So a septic system works where all of the waste from the house is collected in a holding tank with a baffle. I'm just going to explain it really rudimentarily. Of the waste goes into one side of the tank and it ferments, I guess, and then moves slowly over into the other side and continues to decompose, and then it becomes like liquid form. It moves out of the other side of the tank and then it goes down into what's called just a trench. And that trench then disperses the waste water out under the ground. And there's three trenches here, which is quite big. We've only used the first trench by the looks of the grass growing on it. But yeah, it just disperses underground and then sort of just returns into the soil or evaporates out through the top of the soil. So I guess like it's returning.
And you would have had to, pay to have all that installed, like it wasn't on your portion of the land anyway.
Yeah, so that is situated out the front of the house, and I had to pay a plumber to come and put that in. So I helped with that too, but just with measurements and whatnot.
And you're harvesting your own water. Are you getting enough water into the tanks from the smaller roof size because you've got a smaller capture area? Like, how are you doing that?
No. So we don't capture any water off the roof. We just use the bore water, which we have a triple stage filter, UV filter, and just run it. It's drinkable, like straight out of the hole. But we still filter it, and then we use
it. But you like brush your teeth with it. You're not in.
It's delicious. Like, it's great. When we were living in the shack, we were just drinking it straight out of the hole with no filtration. So,
wow.
It's all good. Wow. Like, it's, when they did it, they tested it and they're like, this is just pure, which is awesome.
No giardia. Love it. Now, so we've covered sewerage, water,
electricity.
Electricity. So, we're on town supply, but have we got battery? We've got solar as well.
We don't have a battery just because of the budget. Couldn't really allow it. So we're on grid and that's support. We're on solar, but that is supported by the grid. We've got a 4.5 kilowatt system on there and I've set it up so hopefully in the future we can get batteries when they're a bit more viable. But at the moment, like, it's amazing. Like, they're really high wattage panels. So there's 11 of them and that makes up the 4.5 kilowatts. So yeah, they can really suck it in. Like, it's good. I think over summer we had to pay like a $30 per month service charge. And then with the credits, it's like $5 or something for the electricity to use.
Just for my own curiosity, what brand of solar panels did you go with?
Yeah, so we're with SunPower solar panels with Enphase microinverters, which are AC microinverter.
Yeah.
And I went with those because I sort of had this rule for the project, which is like the buy once, cry once rule. Just buy quality whenever you can, like buy the best thing that you can afford basically, and you hopefully won't be disappointed. But yeah, so basically the panel comes with the microinverter and they are both guaranteed for 25 years of use with like a really small degradation of like 92% output by the end of that 25 years.
With the you've got double brick, which is awesome for insulation. Yep. You've got a concrete slab, which is awesome for insulation.
Somewhat, yeah.
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 Now, you've got a big glass wall, which can be awesome and terrible.
Yep.
So, what are you doing in the extreme colds and the extreme heats, hots or whatever, in extreme heat? I was trying to be cool by saying extreme colds and hots.
Say it away, mate. Yeah, so I guess the glass facade was me being incredibly naive coming into this project and thinking that I can just do what I want because it effectively faces west, which is not really where you want to face too many of your windows, and basically that is all of the glass in the house.
Why did you do that? Why wasn't it north? Was it because of the view or
the view? Yeah, I basically wanted to try and employ systems like utilizing insulation, really good glass, and just building techniques that would prevent the ambient temperature from getting in, but also the UV. So the glass has a layer or a coating which reflects about 70% of the UV rays. So by stopping the UV, the sun doesn't get right in, heat up the house, like heat up the floor, heat up the walls, and then release all of that heat during the day and night. It is sort of doing that a little bit, but not as much as it would if you were to use just a standard double glazed window. So, yeah, I did have to pay extra to get this solar band, it's called, coating on the glass, but definitely well worth it. And now we've lived in it for a couple of summers. I'm looking to get some blinds on there as well just to mainly to stop the glare. But, yeah, it's pretty good. Like, it's facing in a good direction that in the summer the sun goes over. So I didn't just like dump it west and say like, let's hope for the best. It's like put it slightly west. It's kind of like northwest, and the sun,
sure, okay,
the sun does pitch over and the eaves are there to help. So in the hottest months, it's sort of going over the front and there's still light that gets in maybe a couple of meters. And I'm just hopefully, yeah, when we get some blinds and stuff, it'll stop that sort of sun. But in the winter, it sort of sets over to the front and sends in some really nice light and heats the place up a bit.
You don't have a small fireplace or an air conditioner?
Yeah, we do have air cons. I didn't want to put a fireplace in because it would be only used like, well, I actually barely use it in this house anyway. In the winter, like it's just the floor might get a little bit cold, but we'll put a rug down and sort of fix that. But yeah, we have a split system air conditioner unit. So there's one unit outside which has two indoor units inside. And I put those in. So one's down in the the living area, and the other one's upstairs in the bedroom. And I just wanted to do that because I guess I had no idea at the start, but I just wanted to put a fail safe on in case like I really stuffed up here and it just got way too hot in the house. So there's two of them, but we don't use them that often really. We've got a skylight, so there's a lot of opportunity. So I designed in windows that are like operable downstairs and upstairs, well, just the skylight, and you can get a lot of cross ventilation happening when there's slight breeze outside. It really sends the air in and it sort of circulates up the stairway and around the bedroom and then out the skylight. So that works really well.
So if you weren't morning people, you are now with all that light?
Yeah, it's interesting though. Like it's a really gentle light because, I mean, the sun's getting up behind us and it's sort of,
yeah,
like it's amazing. You just watch the mountains because we can see these ranges here, and you just watch the shadow line from behind the house just come down the mountains and slowly lighten up the house. I mean, yeah, definitely if you weren't a morning person, it might be a bit hard, but it's pretty beautiful. Like it's stunning.
What did you do? So did you put extra long eaves on? Because you've got quite a pitch. So I've seen like longer eaves for type of self-thermal or heat.
To stop some degrees of summer sun coming in and some degrees of winter sun to come in. Yeah.
Yes.
Not really. On the front, there's sort of a slight eave. I think it's about 400 mil, which protrudes out the front, and it's just using like the outside perimeter of the structure. So it's basically the basic house shape, and it shoots out the front. And that sort of stops a bit of the sun for like the first half of the day and into the early afternoon, especially in summer. I haven't actually finished the window in the kitchen, which is on the north side. I'm going to build like a tress, like sort of a, oh, I just guess like an eave out the front that you can sort of grow a plant over, which would be nice. But out the side entrance to the south, I've got like a nice sort of entrance made out of hardwood that blocks that late summer sun. And yeah, I sort of thought about like whether I should have made the eaves longer, but I don't think they would have had too much of an effect with this in this case. And yeah, I feel like I've used like some good technical systems to reduce temperature transfer from outside and UV and everything like that. So the house is like really well insulated.
So what did you use on the roof?
For insulation or for cladding?
Or like the cladding. Is it colour bond and then heaps of insulation under it?
It's just Australia's favourite monument colour bond. There is some insulation underneath. There's a fair bit actually. So the cavity in the roof is about, I think it's a 250, 270 mil purlin, which is crammed with, so that's like 270 mil of gap, which is crammed with insulation bats, which are actually recycled wool out of a carpet factory in Melbourne.
Cool.
Yeah, so like where I can, I've tried to use environmentally sustainable materials like every opportunity.
What other materials have you used that were environmentally sustainable?
Pretty much everything. So all of the timber in the house except for the framing in the upper story walls, which is just pine, all of the other timber is recycled hardwood. Some of it's out of basketball courts, so picked up an old basketball court from Camperdown, picked up somebody's hardwood floor in their farm kitchen. that they'd like made 30 years ago and were upgrading, so just went down there and picked it up. What else? There were some purlins and stuff out of an old warehouse that got pulled down in Melbourne that I used for the staircase. A friend was pulling down their old pig farm, and there was just heaps of iron bark there, and I just went in and just loaded up the trailer, took it home,
yeah, nice,
and worked that into the handrail of the staircase, the bathroom door. Like, everything is just literally recycled where I possibly can.
So if you was to say the big pots of cost, would you say the, you said there was like 12 grand of council approval, like DA stuff?
Not in the council approval itself, but in gathering all that paperwork, the final costs are like 12, I think it's about 11, 12 grand. So basically, I think the council fees, you've got to get like a planning permit, which is like, these are probably changed by the way, but for me, yeah, it's, I think $2,200, and then the building permit might have been like a grand, maybe a bit more. And
I guess because you're in the bush as well, you've got to do all the fire stuff as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The bushfire management statement. So somebody comes, you can do it yourself, but it's way better to, trust me, just pay a professional to do this. Somebody in, they'll do an assessment of the location of the house, where it's going to be going, and then they assess the immediate surroundings, but then also the surroundings further out. And they basically make an assessment of the threat to the zone where the house is going to be, and how, if a fire came through and from what particular direction, how threatened that house would be and how it would need to combat against the flame exposure. So there's a few different ratings. When I did it, I think it's still the same. It's like a bell. So a bushfire attack level of 12.5, I think 19, then 29.5, and then 40 plus. And that's just varying degrees of flame exposure. So I think when it gets above 40, it's like you're in direct flame, like just belting the house. So, yeah, when you get that statement, it basically means that you have to build the house within the parameters of each bell rating. It just determines what sort of materials you've got to use.
Yeah, so if it was a higher bow rating, you know, you can't have timber, and you probably have to have sprinklers in the roof and an extra tank and all that stuff dedicated to
it. Yeah, I'm not too sure in extreme, but yeah, definitely for the other levels, you can only use certain types of hardwood on the external. You have to have toughened glass. You have to have cladding that has been rated for fire. You have to block up a lot of your gaps for ember attack. You have to have metal flywire to stop embers getting through, like burning through nylon ones. Like bricks and everything, obviously. Yeah, it's pretty extreme.
So just on the money side, did you get a mortgage for the tiny home?
I did not. I was in a very, I guess you could say, advantageous and also trusted position, fortunate position, say however you want, I guess. But, so I cash flowed it myself while I was building and working in the firefighting position. But I also loaned money, a significant amount of money, from my dad, and also portions from my mum and my partner, Holly. And, I mean, like, that was incredible. It's like, I don't really know what the process would be to get a mortgage if you're an owner builder. It might be quite hard.
Yeah, it's
might be a nightmare. I
think it's. We'll take that on notice, and we'll talk about that on another episode, I think. But it's you need higher LVRs. Lower LVRs. And just on the land, did you have a mortgage on the land?
No. So. Basically, the way that it happened was my dad, he sold up and he retired when he was 80. He was a fair bit older than myself. He was a bit of an older dad, not a bad thing. He sold up when he was 80, retired the accommodation business and moved over to live with his partner in Rosebud. Eventually he knew that I wanted to build a house. I had my own savings, and I wanted to start with that, and he offered to loan me a significant amount of money to purchase the land from mum, and that left me a little bit of money left over to also bankroll the initial building of the house, like getting it to that sort of shell stage.
Mm. Do you mind me asking, like with the loan to mum and dad, is there a payment plan? Are you paying them back when, or is it a probably going to be an inheritance type vibe? What's
So, but like all of them were just so trusting and, I mean, incredibly generous. You know, like dad sold the property and when he moved away, that was all he sort of had and he didn't really have that much, but he loaned me, like I think it was like 100, in the end he loaned me like 180 grand pretty much, and it was all just stipulated under the fact that I think we wrote out this contract that basically said I had 5 years interest-free and at the end of that 5 years, we reevaluate, and then it could just be, you know, whatever we want it to be then. So, I mean, there were no payments back to any of them, and that was, like, just incredible. Like, I can honestly say I wouldn't have been able to build this house unless that was the case. And, I mean, that was really tough. Like, that was hard at the start morally when Dad made the offer. I was really torn about whether I should take it. You know, he's in his 80s. It played on my mind. What happens if he gets sick and he needs the money and I don't have any way of loaning that money because I have a half-finished house? So that really played on my mind. But he kept reassuring me that by loaning me this money, this is actually helping him and making him feel fulfilled and seeing me build something and also helping give me a leg up, I guess.
So are you physically making payments each week or each month back to your parents at the moment, or are you just kicking it down the road for 5 years and then you'll make the call?
No, I'm not paying any back as of yet.
Yeah.
But I do plan on getting I want to consolidate my loans to pay out my debts, basically.
Yeah.
And now that the house is finished, I want to, you know, draw equity from that and pay them out.
And tell me to get stuffed as usual, but like you did speak to a mortgage broker conceptually?
Yeah.
And what, in view to kind of clean all this up and get a mortgage on the property?
Yeah, pretty much. Like basically I want to draw equity from the house and the property value itself. Because I've improved the value of the property now. With this house, and by doing so, I can hopefully get a home loan and then pay out my debts with that.
Yeah.
And then just pay the bank. It's probably a very unique set of circumstances.
Yeah.
I can say that, like, our family is not well off. Like, we haven't always had much money.
But, I mean, is it now because you've got a bigger block, you need to save a little bit more of a deposit to actually put a mortgage on the property because it's a hectare or something like that?
I won't actually need to save any money to put in as a deposit for the mortgage. Like, I've spoken to the banks and they're happy to lend me the money just based on the LVR being, like, I mean, I'm guessing at this stage the properties are worth at least probably $350,000.
Sure.
Minimum. It's probably more than that. But even, let's just say it was that. And the loan is $120,000. Like, you're looking at an LVR of, you know, 30%.
Yeah, cool.
But in regards to the loans, so I did have the loan to Dad, and sadly he passed away last June in 2021. So,
oh, my apologies.
Thanks. He was battling cancer for about 18 months, so that was all throughout the build process. So that, like, that now goes on to the beneficiaries of the will. I'm one of them, but there's a couple of others, and I just really morally I really want to pay them out.
Sure. No, apologies. I probably should have known that before we started
deep.
But I sound like a bit of a dickhead now, but but that's it. We'll move on. But yeah, it's complex, and I guess, and these are the things, like, I would just say in these type of situations, like, you just need to know the lay of the land when stuff does happen.
I mean, absolutely, yeah. Like, you really, I mean, these are all, like, we wrote contracts for all of these loans, but I mean, in the end, there's still a handshake. and they were just so, like, they just trusted me so much that.
Yeah, so you're just in the position now that you feel morally you would like to pay out some of the beneficiaries, be it your siblings or.
Yeah, definitely.
You know.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Definitely.
Cool. Yeah. Well, we might take a quick break and then we'll come back and just answer heaps of questions in the short time we've got left, because at the time of recording, I've got an oven with some potatoes cooking. So we'll be back right after this.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com, click Get Help, and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers, and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
Okay, we're back. Now, let's just ask you some of these questions.
Yep. Go for it.
Okay. What areas of the house, this is from Jean Olido, what areas of the house did you not compromise on in size because you can't live without the comfort or space, and why?
Oof. I think like the kitchen, the bedroom and the bathroom are all, like, they're decent enough. Like there's, they've all got full-size bed, full-size oven. It's got a, like a, English sort of butler sink in the kitchen, heaps of workspace for cooking because that's what we love. The bathroom is a small bathroom. It's got a full-size shower, a proper toilet, like good vanity. I guess the smallest part in the house would be the living room. So it's sort of blaring between living room and dining room where we don't really have a dining room, but we've got a setup so you can sort of sit in the living room area and have dinner. But I'm really happy with the proportions of the house. If I was most proud of anything in the house, from the build of the house, I would say it's the proportions. Like they've fit really well and the space feels like super livable. Even though it is a small house, like people come in here and because we have like this open sort of mezzanine area in the living room, it's got a cathedral ceiling. People just feel like it's way bigger inside than they would have expected. So, yeah, I reckon it's done pretty well, to be honest.
Yeah, cool. Rachel Connard, what are the major pros of a tiny home versus apartment? Is it genuinely a money saver, or do you just really love the outdoors? So are there things, let's flip it the other way, are there things living in this tiny home that actually annoy you?
No. Like I can actually say that I don't think there's much I would change. I think I would answer that with there's a few different reasons why you would build a tiny home. One, you've either got a small budget, which is like great, and you can build it yourself and get into the property market with something small. Another one is that you just see the value in building a quality house. So you're still, you know, you're using really good things inside the house, so like good taps, high quality materials, all these sort of things that are actually quite expensive. But if you build them on a smaller scale, you can have a higher quality.
Mm.
Yeah. And I feel like that's the route that we went down. So like, you know, per square meter, it might be quite expensive. I mean, if you're going to do an in podcast Glenn James calculation, let's do it like 180,000.
Yeah, I'll get my calculator.
180,000 divided by 36 square meters.
Yeah, it's 5,000 per square meter.
Yeah. Actually, let's do 140 because that was the actual house.
Yeah.
It's $3,890.
Let's just do one thing just in comparison. So what did you say, $3,090?
$3,890. So that's probably pretty expensive, but...
Yeah.
Yo.
Hey, I'm just on a podcast recording. Randomly, how much would it cost, like... So your house that you're building at the moment, have you worked out what the square meter cost is?
Oh, no.
Okay. Well, you're useless.
$300,000 for, say, 225 square meters.
Okay. Well, we know it's...
That's going to be way right. under...
Yeah. Years. Yeah, so that's 1,300 a square meter-ish. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. No, I'm just talking to a guy, Benj, who built a tiny home... And it was $3,000 a square metre.
Yeah, the smallies, so a granny flat, which is 60 square metres, they usually cost about 150 to 200. because the most expensive part of a house is the kitchen and the bathroom, and they're basically, the cost is really realistically the same for a tiny home, a granny flat, or a full-size house. The cheapest things to build are living areas and big bedrooms, so the cost sort of, don't get dramatic. They don't jump dramatically because they all have kitchens, they all have bathrooms.
Yeah. All right. Cool. All right. Thanks for that, Dirty Mike. See you later. So, yeah, that was Dirty Mike, friend of mine. He's in building-ish or whatever.
I guess what I can say from that is that, like, I've tried to use the highest quality materials that I can possibly use and systems as well. And I've saved, like, so much money in terms of labor costs. I mean, I've spent, I think by the time we moved in, it was like over 4,000 hours. And if you just charge that out at a rate of $40 an hour, and that's including like building a kitchen, bathroom, all at a high standard, that's like $160,000.
But also, if you step back and have a look at it, you've got your tiny home, you love it, it costs $180 or whatever.
Yeah.
Who cares? It's your life and you like what you spent your money on.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, Lizzie asked, what kind of internet connection do you have? Yeah, so is there NBN or satellite where you are?
Yeah, just NBN, fixed wireless, but, I mean, we could get Starlink if we want, but it's probably a bit too expensive for us.
What would you say, Beta Emmanuel, she asked a heap of questions, I think, to a gal. You know, we've answered a lot of these, but what do you think were probably the most unexpected costs?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I can tell you one, which is pretty funny, but maybe other people would have expected this, but I did a shower grate in the bathroom and they have to be
fancy.
Yeah. No, I love it. But, cause it's custom made. It was like 600 and something bucks, which was definitely a shock. So I'd always planned for it at the start, not knowing what that would cost. Then it hit and I was like, well, but, I mean, there's so many, like there's literally, when you're doing it for the first time, like especially if you're coming in pretty naive, there are so many hidden costs. You literally just have to keep planning as much as possible. I mean, if there's something I learned from this project, it's how you take your losses. I don't know. You've just got to really take them and take them on board.
Yeah, cool. So Jacqueline asks, you know, what was the biggest compromise you had to make? And I'll probably flick that to, if you were doing it again, what would you do differently?
I think I prefer to answer Jacqueline's question.
Yeah. Okay.
The compromises were just the usual, like not spending much money on anything other than the house. So I wasn't going out. Yeah. I wasn't doing that much entertaining, you know, like basically to build the house and cash flow myself as well from my job, I just had to throw like everything at it. Like it was, basically I had two buckets. One was incredibly tiny and that was keeping me alive and feeding me and also giving me a few little fun bits here and there. And then the other bucket was just like there was a funnel into it that was just so big. It was just taking everything and funneling it into the cost of the house. There was a huge compromise on my how much fun I could go and have, you know, that you'd have to pay for. So you have to think of ways of trying to have fun when you actually have time, which I barely had any time anyway. But yeah, like that's just the usual compromises, I think, except on an extreme level. Like it took 3.5 years to build, maybe 3 years. And I was working like in the off season. So we basically worked the fire season over the summer for 6 to 7 months. And then I'd have 5 to 6 months between that season and the next fire season. And I would just work my ass off. So I think in the last off season, I think I had 181 available days to work, and I think I worked like 167 of them, 12 to 14 hours a day.
Wow.
It was crazy. I mean, there were so many reasons that was possible. Like it was, I called it like the perfect storm. It was like dad having cancer and trying to get it done before the next fire season started. Having a limit, like a finite amount of time, it just created this insane amount of drive that I don't think I would ever be able to pull off again.
Yeah.
You know, like getting up at 5:30 in the morning, when it's dark, going outside, working on the house until 7, 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night every day for 6 months. It's pretty brutal, but I mean, I got it done in the end and it was great. But yeah.
What does Holly do for work?
Holly was also on the fire crew with myself, but she moved into another role in Horsham in another depot. She moved into like an office job where she's like an community engagement and communications for the DALP agency who organise burns and whatnot.
Did you have any, particularly for Holly being, I guess, office-based, any work from home lockdowns during COVID in the tiny home?
We were still living in the shack when the lockdowns were happening, when I was still building or when we moved in, do you mean?
When you moved in here.
Yeah, so, yeah, I guess we did. Yeah.
Because, and the only reason I ask that is a leading question, like, this tiny home stuff, like, my personality is not a tiny home guy. Like, yeah. I would like to be, but I'm sorry, it's not. And I think that would then play into the relationship dynamics as well, right? Like, you must really love that quality time all the time, close.
Definitely. I think it's important that you communicate, though, and talk to each other about that sort of thing. Like, I mean, we're so fortunate where we live, like, it's the country and we've got this incredible Gary Word landscape, bushland, the national park, that we can get outside and escape. But it definitely helps. You definitely need your space. I think in this house it's a bit different because we've got an upstairs and a downstairs and somebody can be downstairs and somebody can be up and you can remove yourself from each other. We've also got like a workshop out in the container and that's sort of set up as an office as well. So that's sort of an escape. And then we've got a little shack. So, I mean, I can't say that we're completely just living in the one space all the time together because we have the options to get out. But I totally see what you mean.
Yeah. You've got lovely high ceilings, which, you know, it looks awesome and it doesn't feel as small, I would imagine, downstairs.
Yeah.
How high is the structure?
To the peak, it is 6.5 metres. So it's actually taller than it is long. So, yeah, it's 6 metres long, 4 metres wide, 6.5 metres high. So, it is really high. So when you're standing in the living area and you're looking straight up at the cathedral ceiling, like you're looking up pretty high.
Mm. Okay, a couple more questions. And everyone who commented on the Facebook group, we've organically answered a lot of this stuff. The reason I did paraphrase Jacqueline's question because we talked about compromises in size, which you didn't have any compromises in size, but in terms of life, you had compromises because you weren't going out, you were working on the property or whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Alyssa Ward, hey, Alyssa, how are you? A friend of mine on the show from Hobart. Did you have any issues with your council? Heard lots of stories about certain areas not being allowed tiny homes.
Yeah, so I guess that one's focused more on ones based on a trailer that are portable. So I can't answer that, but I can answer the question about the council. I guess I get asked that fairly often, actually. I think in my circumstance, I actually didn't have any issues with council whatsoever. And I think it is literally because I just gave them as much detail as I possibly could. And yeah, checked every single box that they could possibly give me before handing in my submission. I also paid people who are professionals and they do that, like planning permits, bushfire management statements and all that sort of stuff. I paid them to write the material up for the submission. And I can wholeheartedly say that you should just do that because...
But that's like any bureaucracy. You've got to gift wrap it for the bureaucracy, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, just cross your T's and... Dot your eyes.
All that stuff. I'm just having a look here. Look, was there anything, Ricky Cook, hey, mate, he's a friend of mine, we're in the same kindergarten class as Ricky and we're still friends. We go four-wheel driving and all that. He says, is the TV too tiny? Like, do you even have a TV?
Yeah, we have a TV, but it's definitely not like the centerpiece of the house. Yeah. Like, it's on the side wall and you just look out the front of the house and you've got your bush tally, just looking out the glass, like it's amazing view.
Bigger the TV, bigger the bogan, Ricky. But
the TV is still 42-inch, so, I mean, probably small in today's standards, really, let's be honest.
I've got a question. I think I've answered most of that crap, so we can throw that out. Oh, actually, my notes. Do I need them for the show notes? Sun Power, I'll keep that because I wanted to know what brand your solar was. My question is, if you and Holly so choose and you're willing and able and all that to spawn the earth and populate the earth and all that stuff, future plans for growth, you know, if you want 15 kids, what are your plans? Is it we're going to build another house on the property and then have this as a studio on Airbnb? Like, what's future plans look like?
No, we can't really extend this house. Like, it's done to its full capacity. So, yeah, we would probably need to buy another house or build another house of some description.
But is your current block big enough to build not a tiny house but maybe a medium house or a tiny house Mark II?
Not really. Like, we've basically used up all the space that we can now.
Oh, okay. So there wasn't much usable space on your...
No, like there's a covenant, like a building envelope, sorry, not a covenant.
Sure.
Where we had to build the house, and we've used that up now. It was very specific. So, again, that really reaffirms, like, keeping the place as minimal impact as possible. And we basically returned the entire hill to plants, like the garden. The whole hill is a garden now. So there's nowhere to put a house anymore other than where this one is.
Yeah, right. So what does the future look like for your current property?
I would definitely like to run it as a business. So I went into the project with the idea that, it's like father, like son, like building accommodation. Yeah, I went into this knowing that the outcome would be to run it as a business. So my next stage in life is to run this as a B&B, hopefully. I never really knew how long the project was going to take. Like, it took way longer than I thought it was going to take, but it was a beautiful journey in the end. But it was always the plan to move into the house, live in it for a while, work out the kinks, get it looking nice, just figure out how it functions, and then, yeah, turn it into a business and hopefully rent it out for other people to enjoy. So that is the goal. And I'm currently trying to cram as much business research in as possible. So my millennial business has been great. I've been waking up here with you every morning at 5:30, mate, carting rocks on the garden for an hour and a half before work.
Bless you. And we've actually, so if you are interested in side hustles, small businesses and all that, My Millennial Business, it's a banging podcast. We've got a new host, Fabio Dosrees. He's going to host podcast.
Awesome.
So his photo will be on the cover. He's going to do it. But because I love small business so much, I've reserved the right to jump on and do a business takeover rant whenever I want. So
yeah, please do. They're actually really, I've really been enjoying them. I think they're fantastic. Mm.
Cool. So I guess from one tiny home to another, I've got a little townhouse, but it's not really a tiny home. Any final words of advice, practical advice for people?
Oh, geez. I wrote a bit of a list here, so I'm just...
Oh, yeah. Do you want to just read them out?
Yeah. The how and the learnings. SketchUp, which is CAD software. It's free and it's incredible. So I basically designed the house in SketchUp probably like 4 or 5 times, and then I utilized SketchUp as my measurement system. And as I built the house, I would just take measurements from SketchUp, apply them in the real world with the materials that I had. Sometimes, because they're recycled, they change the actual dimensions a little bit. So you just alter it back in SketchUp. And then, it's the most powerful tool that I had for the entire build. It's incredible. Its benefit to your project cannot be understated for sure. I think planning, like, that is just like anything in life. Planning is so important. Plan as much as possible. If you're naive, which I was, you've got to try and cover yourself. So you've got to try and research and plan on the go prior to wherever possible, because you want to minimize your risk of making a mistake. And you're definitely going to make them, but that's okay. Like, there's always a way around them. It's, I mean, it's how you handle the mistakes that make you who you are, I reckon, and that's what will really define your project. I've got another CAD software in there, which is Fusion 360, really good for sheet metal stuff, probably not applicable to everybody. In a small space, like every centimeter matters, like it's so important. So build storage space in everything, like literally everything, in your bed, in your chairs, in your wall cavities. You know, you've got a 90 mil internal wall, you've got 90 mil cavity, utilize that space. You can put something in there, like you can put it everywhere and you will thank yourself for it, because you can store lots of good stuff in all those hidden places. And that takes lots of planning. Like that, I reckon that's where a lot of my time went.
Would you say before you embark, go on Airbnb in a couple of tiny homes just to get a vibe for what other people have done?
Yeah, that's definitely a valid point. I reckon that'd be great. I mean, there's a really good show, like there's heaps of tiny home shows on YouTube now, but the best one is Living Big in a Tiny House, so this New Zealand couple who make that. And they put up a video every week of a tiny home, and you can get so many different ideas. They're primarily tiny homes on wheels, but if you want to get immediate research in that's fun and really helpful, just watch all of those episodes back to back. It'll take you about a year, but that's okay. Yeah, don't underestimate the power of your friends and connections, like networking and everything like that. Just be open with people and talk to them about what you're doing, and they might be able to help you out. Barter systems are great, you know, not paying for something but returning the favor somehow else, but just be strict on how that will work. Some people just want to do stuff for you for free, and you can bet you can't you can't even insist on paying them.
That's like my staff. They just are awesome. There's four of them. They work for free. They're like, no, don't pay us. Don't pay us.
If you do stuff yourself, like, it's gonna save you a lot of money. I think the biggest learning I had from this whole project is time. Like, everything is literally traded in time. So if you want to speed up the process, you have to trade money. If you want to get something and you don't have the money, you've got to do it yourself, or you've got to wait till you've got the money. So by doing stuff yourself, you're saving a lot of cash, but it increases the time. So I basically did like 90% of the work on this house by myself, and that increased the time that it took. So I definitely think that's a really good one to consider. And also on that, let the professionals do their job. So I didn't do the plastering. Thank goodness I didn't do that. I had somebody pour the slab for me. I just helped. But, I mean, that is the foundation of the house, so I just didn't want it to be wrong. And then I didn't do the bricklaying. I just was the brickies bitch, as you'd probably say, and helped out with that. But then after that, I pretty much did most of the other stuff. Be cool if I just keep reading through some of these? Or?
Yeah, just keep reading. I'm just going to go and check on my oven.
Go for it, mate. Go for it.
You just keep reading. I'm going to turn the so I'll be able to hear it.
Yeah, no worries.
Turn my speaker up. Go.
Yeah, so always be open to adjusting your design. Yeah, I think it's really important that as you go along and as you're building, don't think that you know everything, especially if you're new to this. If people have got suggestions, it's, you know, have the right people to spitball ideas with, soundboard and whatnot, because it's really important to get external advice on something you're thinking about doing.
Did you have to turn away the energy from the naysayers?
I think that's down to character. I think I was just so fixated on the project, and I knew exactly what I wanted, and I designed it to like the nth degree before I had started. I just had this whole vision in my head that nobody else could see. And if you're like that, you just have to trust yourself and back yourself. And it's also really hard then to tell people like what your vision is, because it's just in your mind. And when people do make comments, like, yeah, it is hard to take, you should take it on board, definitely. But if you know what you want and you can back it up with like supporting evidence that you think will make it work, just back yourself. Like, trust your gut. That is another one. Trust your gut. If you've got enough evidence to support your decision, then trust it for sure. Yeah, I've got one here. Utilize the well-trodden path. Talk with those who've done something similar. Use their experience to develop, improve your own. So there's no point reinventing the wheel. There's a few cliches for you, but there just really isn't any point. Like, if something's been done before, the whole building and construction industry is set up on standards. Like, there's standard sizes and things for everything that's, you know, all the building materials and whatnot that you can get to build a house. So it makes things cheaper. There's certain ways of doing things that make them more efficient. There's certain ways of doing things that make them higher quality. Like, it's important to surround yourself with people who can give you some good advice around how they've approached something. So, like, I don't know, maybe there's communities out there, well, there would be forums and stuff where you can ask these questions. But if you can surround yourself with actual physical people that you know and you trust, it's so important and so helpful. And on that, like, have a small team around you that you trust. And also use trade people that you trust as well. Like, it's just building up that rapport means that when somebody comes and works on your project, that you can just stand back and let them do their thing and trust them and know that they're going to do the right thing, which takes out a lot of anxiety, probably for most people. For me, I was anxious all the time when somebody else came and worked on my project, but that's because I was such a control freak and wanted to do everything. But, you know, that's all right.
All right, bring it home, Benj.
All right. You know what? This is pretty applicable across a lot of things. Compounding seems to be something that's really important in money, but it's also applicable to building. So I've written here the importance of chipping away day by day, little by little, and watching the compounding effect take hold in the form of progress. So like I said before, I've been getting up at 5:30 every morning before work and putting rocks on the garden. So I'm trying to mulch the garden with rocks. It's a massive job. Like, I've literally done like 250 barrow loads, and there's probably another 150 to go.
You'll have to put some current photos up of the garden progress and all that on your Instagram.
Definitely. I'm hoping to do a little tour sometime soon.
Yeah.
Which I'll try and do before this episode goes live.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, every day I just do an hour and a half, hour of rock carting in the dark before work. And at the end of the week, I can look back and I can see that I've covered so many square meters, or there's a wall being built or something like that. And, you know, if you just keep chipping away, like, that's what happens. Like, it's amazing. It's quite surprising. And the same thing happened with the house, although a much more intense level and much longer hours for the day. But I chipped away every single day, especially in that last 6 months. And I got there, got to the end, and yeah, we had a house to live in. So compounding and just doing little by little, like, if you've got a bit of spare time at home and you're not doing anything and you're watching TV and you've got a project to work on, you should probably just ask yourself, maybe if I just slip out and do like 20 minutes here, 20 minutes there, if you can, it'll help. Like, it's massive. But I know you've probably seen the same thing in your business as well.
Well, and that's it. Like, I really, you know, with my life, you know, the TV isn't the hero of my living room. It's to the side, and it doesn't mean I'm always having to watch TV. And, you know, if you know who's getting married on Married First Sight, or you know who's about to get voted off the Survivor Australia Island or whatever, it means you actually have spare time in your life to work on stuff that matters. You've just chosen. And I get downtime and recreation and all that, so go with me, everyone. Like, we've made the choice that, you know, it's habit that we watch a show every night on TV versus, well, why don't I watch one show and then not binge it, and then the next day, well, and then after that, I work on my project. So
definitely. I mean, it's all about self-control in the end as well, and how much motivation, how much drive you have. I definitely think it's important. Like, I'll just really go back on that point about having a support network. You can't underestimate the importance of friends and family and just people who can be there to just offer advice on a technical level, but also emotional support. Like, it's so important, because if you're working yourself to the bone, somebody needs to be able to pull you up and tell you, like, you need to stop, or you need to be able to talk about how it's affecting you emotionally. And, you know, like, if you're working so much that you can't be social, like, that's going to be detrimental to your own mental health. And I certainly noticed that in myself, and may have pushed it a bit too far, but I mean, it was so important that I could talk to friends and family about that.
All right. We might leave it there. Thanks for your sage advice. You can follow and have a look at the tiny home Nook_on_the_hill
Please do.
On Insta.
I'll try and put up some more content for people to watch. But you can basically watch it from Breaking Earth to completion and moving in.
Yeah, scroll down to the bottom. Everyone will probably be there. Thanks for lending us your time and giving us some practical tips.
Oh, you're welcome.
And, on behalf of everyone at My Millennial Money, thank you. And thanks to Holly as well for all the work she's put in on the tiny home as well.
Couldn't have done it without her. Definitely could not have done it without her. I feel like I could talk about this for hours, mate, but you have to go.
Yeah.
There's some potatoes waiting for you.
There is potatoes waiting, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me on, and I would just like to take this opportunity to also thank you for everything you do with your podcast and everything else. Like, I've learned so much from you, and it's just super helpful, mate. Like, it's obviously much more than just making money for you, like, so much more. It's about helping people, and you've helped me, certainly.
Yeah, no worries. Well, I really appreciate that. And it's just great to, when we do these type of episodes, that, like, I get to talk to people who listen and consume our content, and like, you get to give back to this community, you know what I mean? So
yeah, definitely. And I mean, if anybody's got questions, and I may be opening up Pandora's box here, but if anybody's got
slide
any questions,
into the DM,
mate, chuck them in the DMs of the Instagram or on that My Millennial Money post about tiny houses. Like, just chuck them in there for sure, and I'll try and answer as many as possible.
Awesome. All right. See you soon.
Cheers, mate. Thank you.
We acknowledge the Darkin Young people, traditional custodians of the land on which our studio sits, and pay respect to their elders, past and present. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to our podcast.
My Millennial Money supports A21, a charity focused on abolishing slavery and human trafficking all over the world. Check out a21.org.au for more info. If you would like some other giving options, or if you're unsure about which charity you can support, head to thelifeyoucansave.org.au.
This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Cymo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, is an authorised representative of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451-289.